So a couple episodes ago, we talked all about email, which makes sense because we started Boomerang, right?
Yes.
And we said that nothing had changed really in the last 25 years. And most of our productivity advice was from the early 2000s.
Well, we didn't say nothing has changed. We're saying in terms of email management and productivity advice.
Yeah. Today is going to be the opposite of that. Today is going to be all about what has changed, especially in the last 5 years, since the pandemic changed a lot of everything, including how we do email.
And I think it's the role of email change as the workplace environment change. Is that right?
Absolutely. So today we'll talk all about those changes. And because chat and remote meetings have become so much more important of a part of our workday, this episode is not just going to be about email. It's going to be about how those work too.
So going from having zero Zoom meetings to 100% Zoom.
And chat, Teams, Slack. All these things are now part of the way we work. Hey there, I'm Alex.
And I'm Mo.
We met at MIT, got married, co-founded Boomerang, invented email snoozing, and have spent a lot of time geeking out about productivity.
On Less Busy Lab, we'll share
and argue about
research-backed tips, productivity hacks, and secrets from 15 years of running a small team that does big things.
There are no silver bullets in productivity, but we'll try to help you get more done while feeling less busy. Let's go. So if you asked me in 2018 what you should do about email, I would have said, okay, you need to be really asynchronous. You really want to batch up your email, let it build up, and only check it 2 or 3 times a day. And if you do that, you'll have less stress, you'll be more productive, and your team will actually thank you. And if you ask me that today, that's not what I'd say.
What's the difference now? What are you going to say?
So the big difference is that, like you said, the role of email in how we communicate has changed a lot since the pandemic happened. And the role of digital communications has changed even more.
Is it just the synchronicity, how long people wait for a response in terms of expectation?
That's some of it. When we were starting Boomerang, and for the first 10 years of the company's existence, we were all in person.
Right.
And 60% of the folks who did work that could be done remotely were doing it in person every day.
You mean national, not our team?
Yeah, nationally. Our team was all in person.
Right.
And so I remember I hated Slack. I tried to get as much stuff off of Slack as we could possibly get off of Slack because it was the worst of everything.
No, I remembered how you view Slack. And I guess the role of Slack when you are all in person together, sitting 3 feet away from each other, versus the role of Slack when you're in different states and country cities, definitely it has to evolve.
Yeah. So there's a whole theory called media richness theory that talks about how, if you're communicating with someone via channel, how much information do you get from that communication?
So in person versus sending a text message.
Exactly. And when you're in person, you get the person's facial expressions, you get their body language, you get the tone of their voice, you get so much more
information.
Whether
they're sweating.
Sometimes an issue in Alabama.
Maybe you don't want that much information.
Pheromones. But you get a lot more information than just the text of what they're saying.
Right.
And even with email, you get the benefit of it being asynchronous. It's not interrupting you. And you get the richness of a subject line and a sort of more contained thing. Slack is like the absolute disembodied, like here is a contextless piece of information with no associated anything.
Well, the other part that we had trouble with for Slack was it tend to favor people who are faster and type, you know, very zingy short responses and get it out there. And our team tend to have a little bit more thoughtful, reserved people who wants to compose their thought and write it out in a complete 5-paragraph response. And it's not perfectly a natural match for some of, or most of our team and how they thought.
Yeah, that's also true. And so it just kind of felt like it was bad in it.
Well, you were getting the synchronous communication that you need in person, so you didn't care that Slack was good at that.
So since the pandemic, we're completely remote now. We
right.
see our teammates in person 2 or 3 times a year, maybe a little bit more for some of them who are around or fly in for something, but we don't see them most days.
Right.
There's a study that they conducted out of the University of Mannheim over in Germany, where they looked at workers who were trying to communicate across time zones and working remotely and virtually. And they found that the folks who, when you're in a completely virtual environment, the more virtual meetings you have and the more synchronous chat you have, the closer the team felt together, the more they gelled.
Mm-hmm.
Email didn't do that. The more email they had, there was no impact whatsoever on how close they felt with them.
Yeah. Slack does have its own culture building. You know, we have our own custom emoji that we have, you know, over time put in.
My favorite's Chompy.
I thought mine is like the finger. The finger is still there. There is some water cooler moments still in Slack.
Yeah, we have a whole channel, the name of which I will not name, but it's the water cooler. And it's where people put stuff like, oh, there's a big traffic accident on the highway I need. And then we all pay attention a little bit to the traffic. And here's a picture of us going hiking while we're on vacation.
And I think the initial reports of remote work, right, when we first went from everybody full-time on-site to full-time remote, it was Facebook especially. Like, oh my God, we didn't see productivity difference and didn't see the loss of the media richness in communication. And I think that was because the team that went remote were already a team, right? They already knew each other. They already have the culture. They already have their internal language that they have developed. And you move it to Slack, you don't lose as much. But then over time, you have these new employees that are starting remote and joining, and they haven't built that, I don't know, community and friendship and internal language with the rest of the team.
Yeah.
So it's a lot harder for them to get the same level of media richness from the same amount of Slack.
What you're talking about is called channel expansion.
Mm.
And it shows that the closer your team, the longer your teams work together, the better they know each other, the more experience they have working together or communicating in general, the more they can fill in the gaps. And the channels that seem less rich, like email in particular is the most studied, starts to feel richer and richer because the team already has that shared language. And it grows. The amount of richness you get out of a channel grows the more experience you have working in it. So I think that's why the pandemic felt more seamless than it seemed like it should have when it was so disruptive.
Because it's existing team moving from one channel to another.
Exactly.
And we're filling in about what they are typing on Slack or sending on email with what we already know about the person. So you're reading the email in Mike's voice.
Exactly.
When you read it, right? Because you know what he would say.
I'm filling in Mike's face as I'm reading the email he wrote.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, though. The kind of the challenges, though, for our team especially, we have almost half the team that's been with the company 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, long term. And then we have half the team that came in after we went remote. And bridging that gap is something we have to be super conscious about.
Yeah, while we were doing research for this show, you talked about how we might need to set up some scavenger hunts for new employees to make them engage on Slack a little.
Right.
And I've been trying really hard to do more work session so that they have that one-on-one. But I feel like working together really helps build them.
The channel expansion means if you have prior relationship or the relationship that have built over time. So if you know somebody, is it like this like AOL, you know, friendship that we made in the 90s where you've known somebody on online forum for 20 years and you feel like you know them?
You know, I've only met a couple of people who I've known online in the real world later and become friends with them. But I've had a lot of folks I know of have done that. And they've usually been, the people have been who they expected they were. They might look a little different or they might have a weird mannerism, but it's underneath. I think you are who you are.
The personality transferred regardless of the channel and the medium. But if you don't have time, right, if you are new and you just join and all you have is Slack and email and you have weekly meetings, but then, you know, everybody hates too many meetings. So you don't want too much overload on Zoom video meetings. So So how does a new person get the same level of comfort in communicating with the existing team?
I think it takes a long time. And I think it's just something where you have to set the expectation. It's going to take a little long. The other big thing that's changed is there's been a shift in how people report their relationship with interruptions. Back when we were building Inbox Pause in 2015, everything that was out there about interruption was how bad they were.
Mm-hmm.
There were all kinds of things about how
it increased stress.
Heart rate variability declines, so the measures of stress increase.
It lowers IQ.
There's actually a thing called email apnea.
What's the email apnea?
Email apnea is like sleep apnea. A researcher at Microsoft found that she was holding her breath while she was doing email. And so she hooked people up to breath monitors. And she found that they hold their breath longer and breathe much shallower when they're doing email or messaging than when they're doing more focused work.
Fascinating and kind of terrifying.
Kind of terrifying, yeah. So it's like the sleep apnea stuff. Your breathing pattern changes in a not very good way while you're hooked
up. You're starving your brain of full oxygen you need.
Possibly.
While you're dealing with messages.
Yeah, yeah. Everything was so negative. But post-pandemic, some of the surveys are starting to show that there's now a correlation between feeling like you're responsive to other people and self-reported measures of productivity. People feel like if they're responding to others in a timely way and they're not blocking anything, they feel more productive. And that also increases their job satisfaction.
But does it actually correspond to effective productivity, though? Because you could chase being responsive forever and do nothing else.
Yeah, that's true. But before, it was like a boot of this is bad, this is bad, this is bad.
Interruptions are always bad. You should always be async, right? There's like a line of research on, especially the Microsoft productivity team, where they're like, everything should just be async. And there are very extreme companies out there.
There are.
That promote like everything should be async. I'll send the email when I want to. You respond it when you want to. And like, they are very extreme company where we don't ever have face-to-face meeting, where they do Loom videos and send it to each other.
I think that will result in a team that doesn't feel all that gelled and will also probably result in people not feeling like they're responsive and being less satisfied. They may get more done, but they won't feel like they are, and they probably won't be that close to their teammate.
What's the measure that's like self-satisfaction or like just happier? What exactly are they measuring that is increasing with responsiveness?
We're not going to go that deep into it because I don't want to say something wrong.
Okay. Well, so now I wanted to kind of loop back to being hybrid and remote means people are lonelier. Like, so when people talk about the benefit of hybrid, they're like, I get to see my coworkers and feel less lonely, right? And that maybe that also is tied to why people are enjoying being responsive more. It makes you feel less disconnected.
It replaces the richness with some synchronicity.
Yeah.
And if you don't have any way to be rich, at least you can be synchronous.
Synchronous enough, yeah.
So I think the findings broke down a little bit deeper. The feelings of always being on and being interrupted and feeling overwhelmed hasn't changed. Like burnout's actually increased since the pandemic, and it's worse for remote work. About 50% more remote workers report feelings of burnout over people who are in the office. So I don't think the pendulum hasn't swung all the way to interrupt me constantly, but it also isn't quite as much on the let's be completely asynchronous and do our work in silo.
Is that because this lack of work and life separation that's making people burned out, or is there something else?
Who knows? I think one of the things that I think there's probably two trends overlaid on that. One of them is that people probably didn't have work on their smartphone back in 2017, 2016, and now everybody does. So I think the fact that work can follow you around wherever you go is probably bad for burnout.
Yeah, I mean, there's the smartphone. There's the, you know, hey, my work is two steps away. I'm going to pop in and check on something. Even though it's after hours.
there was a real sense of like, I'm out of the office right now and I'm home. But what do you do when you're home? It's,
yes.
You get that feeling of separation.
And then there's the decompression time that you get, right? The transition in the commute. Regardless of how long or short commute is, you get this context switch. All the things that are open threat for work, you're kind of like, at least I can close it out until I come back to work tomorrow morning. Versus when they have no physical transition, they can follow you around a little bit more, just mentally.
So I think the right approach, I know we push be very asynchronous, batch everything up. I think we need to bend a little. And I think the advice I would give now is that you have to be a little bit more in the middle.
So I need to do email a little bit differently now.
Are you still batching?
I'm still batching, and I still only respond maybe 3 times a day.
That might be a little too little now.
But I don't know. I don't feel like that's making me less productive. At least like my self-perception of productivity.
Well, you also said a responsiveness default. I'm not very responsive.
At least people who are dealing with me know what to expect. So I don't have that stress of I am not responsive enough. I think that's a self-imposed stress that people get.
So when we were talking about the episode, you were talking a lot about the way interruptions happen matters. And that's also
right.
New research.
Yeah. So Microsoft has been doing a lot on cause of interruptions and what does it mean, types of interruption, and then how to measure the cost of interruption. So if you are in the middle of writing a very deep strategy document in the middle of a sentence, if I interrupt you at that time versus you finish checking email and you are going from one email to the another, those are two different level of interruption cost. And because how much time it will take for you to go back into that strategy doc, figure out where you were, and restart, it takes a lot longer because people get into this diversion chains and you go from one, you got a notification for this application, you go check at it, you see a Slack, somebody talk about a meeting, so now you're in Google Calendar, and then you see something else in the Google Calendar. And then you click through that link and now you're on a website filling a form for something else, right? And that diversion chains are always there, but like depending on what you were doing prior to that, the cost is a little bit different. And there's the self-interruption versus external interruption.
This is the part I thought was really interesting. Because mm-hmm. We talked in a previous episode about the kind of floating around general wisdom that it takes 23 minutes to recover from an interruption.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not
universally true for everything. Yeah,
yeah, there's a wide range. Mm-hmm. It's not just every interruption is 23 minutes. It's some interruptions are zero.
Mm-hmm.
Some interruptions are an hour.
Right.
And so the research that Microsoft was doing was super cool because it really tried to quantify, like, when are interruptions okay? When are they bad?
Self-interruptions are a little bit easier to recover because, one, when you're at a good point, so you are naturally going to be like, I'm going to finish this last sentence or last paragraph. Then you also store in your brain what you were doing, right? Okay, I'm finishing this sentence or I'm finishing this slide. And then you may even think, okay, when I come back, I just need to do X, Y, and Z. So you do this three-step process of good stopping point. This is what I'm doing. You kind of file it away and then give yourself like a marker for what I'm going to do next. And then you go and check Slack, right?
I think I've subconsciously done this forever.
Right.
Because I'm always like, oh, I'm stuck here. And then instead of sitting there and squeezing, I'm just like, I'll go check something else.
Right. And then, but if you get a notification that shows up in your vision and, oh, your attention is completely taken away, so you skip those three steps of storing away where you need to go back to.
That makes sense because you're not in control.
Right.
You
didn't do it. Yeah. And it was not voluntary interruptions. So then what happens is you just got pulled out. You're going to whatever the application that interrupted you. And then when you come back, you have to do all the steps. So where was I? What was I doing? And then how do I continue from here? So there are some good tips that you can train yourself to do better at interruption resumption, right? So you can say, even if I get an alert, I am going to note myself down what I'm going to do next. And the most important thing, and you know, I've talked about opening the browser window before you leave kind of thing.
Yeah.
Same thing. Try to not get the thing that you're supposed to get back to completely out of your view. So even if you don't have two monitors, if you can, leave that window open. Don't hide it. And then go to the other thing so that it will always be there to remind you come back. If you can't do it, at least partially visible to you. That way you'll be like, oh, that's what I was doing. That's what I needed to get back to.
Keep it in an open.
Keep it in a visibly marker of where you need to go back.
I usually am only using my one monitor and I usually have my laptop open and nothing. So maybe I'll start dragging it over there.
So that,
interruption. I just realized that I have still my Google Calendar alerts set up to come in 10 minutes before the meeting. And they're interrupting my focus. And I really don't need 10 minutes anymore because I don't have to get up and walk anywhere. I don't have to go find the meeting. These are all virtual meetings. I really need to set up that to be like 2 minutes before the meeting. Then I won't be late because it'll actually be timely enough. And it also won't be interrupting me 10 minutes before I need to be interrupted with one of those forceful interruptions.
Yeah. I have a 3 minutes timer. So like our stand-up is at 10:40 and my alarm on my phone goes off at 10:37. So that I have like 3 minutes to file myself away when I need to stop. I have that 3 minute range to go this way. This is where I need to get back. Context switch.
I want to ask one more question. If you don't have an answer to it, it's okay. We'll cut it. But did Microsoft, when they were talking about the diversion chains, did they talk any more about that besides just like an example? Did they give like a histogram or any more sense of like how those things unfold? Because I've heard the statistics, but this sounds fascinating.
I think they actually were trying to develop a universal heuristic on like how to measure interruption. So they were coming up with pretty interesting stuff. And you know what? One thing that they know for sure is like having all the full context of whether your calendar gives you information or whether this person is in a meeting or not, right? They were doing eye gaze measurement. So if you're looking at the computer, are you actively typing or mousing?
Okay.
And then what document you are in, and then what's the nature of the document? So that's the level of detail that they were trying to get for interruption measurement.
It was a pretty intrusive.
Very interesting.
It's not something you'd want to just have going all the time.
No. And then what they found was like, if you found a interruption pattern and like the diversion chain for one person, and if you just take it and apply it to somebody else, it doesn't work. Ooh. Because what interrupts me easily or what are my natural interruption point? Because what they're trying to find is optimal point for the system to interrupt you.
So it knows you need to be interrupted.
Yes.
But it wants to make it as least disruptive
as least
as
disruptive
possible.
Right.
Okay.
So then they were calculating that cost and benefit ratio of one to interrupt. And they just were like, the formulation for each person is not the same. But like, how long do I take to get back to, I think it probably is also relevant to how much I like the test that was being interrupted, right? Like,
I was going
to
say, some of these, I'm never coming to have your shot.
Right. So that must be why if they take a one person's model and then apply it to somebody else, it just doesn't work. But if they take it from multiple people and make a composite and then use that to apply it to somebody new, it works better, but it's still not 100% applicable.
That makes sense.
So I think it has to be super, super personalized thing. And it's such a fascinating way for AI and ability to track what people are doing. Basically, it's like flow state protector, right? That's what I want to build, at least, is know that I'm in flow state, right? And don't interrupt it. But if you must interrupt, what's exact point in this session you should interrupt me?
And to do it smart enough with enough autonomy and not having it be like, okay, this is a tier 8 interruption, so otherwise no one would ever.
Right. And I think maybe like a peripheral vision kind of alert of, this is coming up when you have a chance, switch to it, versus like, boom, dialogue that just take over.
A giant blinking screen.
Yeah.
That's super cool. So we talked about trying to protect flow state a little bit as a leader. And I think the expectations for especially like a hybrid and remote team, I think we've got to shift even ours a little bit within the company to try to optimize for
more responsive,
being responsive, but also having a risk of burnout from being all on.
Yeah, I think the prevention of burnout is more than just like, hey, be more responsive. I think when you are off, you should truly, truly be off. And I have my inbound pause on a schedule for the last year, right? At 6 p.m., my work email doesn't come to me anymore. And then the next morning at 7 a.m., it resumes. And the first like week or so, I would compulsively check work email at night or after dinner. And after like first three or four nights, realizing like your brain finally rewired, there is nothing. There is no dopamine hit for you. So then I stop and I don't check anymore, right? So that should be part of, if you're especially remote or hybrid and you get used to, I'm continuously checking work email and Slack overnight outside of work hour. Outside of work hour, don't check at all. During the work hour, the core hours that you set, check more often.
I think I used to have inbox pause pre-pandemic set up to deliver to my inbox three times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on some level, I kind of subconsciously realized that it's not as responsive as I need in a remote. Synchronicity is valued thing. Because I shut it off during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I never turned it back on at all, which I'm embarrassed to admit. But I think I should set up the schedule you've got and continue to be on it and responsive, but also not at night, because I still do check it. And I know it's not good, but I do anyway.
Yeah, from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m., emails are arriving instantaneously, responding, right? And I think that's what we need to be encouraging.
As a leader in the company, consider that right now, it is more optimal for people to be more responsive and try to set up times where there's an expectation that, so that there is still time.
Well, make a time.
Work 2 hours. And there's not an expectation. That's it.
Yeah, and I think it's important for this to be explicit, right? The one thing that teams need to do is, for us, we have our core hours. And outside of core hours, people have flexibility. They can say, my work hour is 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Or we have some people who prefer to be like 9:30 to 5:30, right? And we need to make sure that it's normal for people to explicitly state, these are my work hours. And during those hours, and we should have a very clear team agreement that in those work hours that you have stated, people have the right to expect responsiveness. And I explicitly said, we may pull you into ad hoc meeting. And expectation is you should be able to join an ad hoc conversation or meeting within 10 minutes, right? What that means is you go off and load a dishwasher or a laundry machine, that's fine. In core hours that people expect you to be responsive, you're not off riding your bike on a mountain, right?
And I think that's fair.
But it's explicit. We put it out there and make it clear. And when people do this remote and hybrid without explicit, what is the expectation?
Yeah, because you can be effective asynchronous. There are people who are, and companies or cultures that are. And maybe you do your best work at 9 p.m. to 11 p.m.
Right.
And there are cultures that are totally okay with that.
Yep.
And whether or not we are or not depends. There's a matching function.
Right. I think it's all depends on how collaborative. Maybe I'm a dinosaur. Everybody's, just do a Loom video. And even Atlassian and Confluence is doing a lot of voice notes features shoved into our face. I don't
know
if you've seen
it. Shitty they're at. Gotten? It ain't working, guys. Go back on site.
It's a different conversation. I'm talking about Atlassian by way of feature introduction saying people should just, you see a page, record your voice note and send it off.
Oh, I see.
Right? So they are really moving to everybody should be just doing work at their own time. And this back and forth, right? Part of the human experience is ability to ask questions and get real-time answer. So that depending on the answer, you ask the next question and shape a conversation. There are very serious leaders out there who thinks I should just send off looms and voice notes and never have that back and forth.
No dialogue.
No dialogue, because it's, I don't know why they think that's the most effective way, mostly because trying to sync and have that conversation is not easy. There's logistic, especially if you have a big team with different time zones, different lives, like, could be hard. It's just that I don't know how to do it.
So on that note, what's our tip of the week?
I think back to be more synchronous while protecting your off hours and maker time. So I think it's more a stream bimodal instead of be completely async or completely synchronous all the time. There are especially startup founders out there who expect their employees to be super responsive. And there are conversations from very famous tech leaders like, oh, if I send an email and I don't get the response within that hour or two, I count the founder out, right? There are VCs who just won't fund you because you didn't respond to their email on Saturday at 9 p.m. And it's their right and it's how they think about it. But our recommendation is when you're on, be responsive, be available.
But in a check frequently kind of way, rather than a let notifications
interrupt you. Yes, if notifications off by default.
I think that's still good advice from 25 years.
Yes, because self-interruptions are way less costly to your productivity than interruptions driven by other people. And then, but protect your personal time. Really log off. Train yourself to not check anymore at nights and weekend and get off that dopamine hit.
So you heard it here first. Shut off your inbox and listen to Less Busy Lab. Wishing you a productive week.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Less Busy Lab. If you haven't already, please.
Can I say it? I want to say it.
Okay, fine.
Smash that subscribe button.
Are you happy now?
So happy.
Please subscribe to our podcast to get all our future episodes. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Find me on LinkedIn for more behind-the-scenes content and updates.
We'll put the links to all the research papers, tools, and templates mentioned in the episode in the show notes.
We'll also be adding a listener questions segment in the future episodes. So if you have any productivity-related questions, send us an email at questions@lessbusylab.com.
Our sponsors this week are the same as they are every week, GQs and Boomerang. Check them out.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you're already feeling less busy and more productive.